uncharted political territory today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Government dysfunction gave us a shutdown in Washington. In Germany, it's an inconclusive election that has them scrambling.
This is all uncharted territory for Germany. We have not been in a situation where we have taken so long to form a government.
Plus, a brutally honest analysis of U.S. policy in the Middle East.
This is why a lot of the U.S. moves seem rather incoherent, is because they are incoherent.
And in Liberia, a former soccer star rides his popularity all the way to the presidency.
Liberia loves me, and I know I'm going to meet the expectation, because when people love you, you have to strive for them.
That's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad you could be with us today. And it looks like the U.S. government shutdown is over. The Senate managed to reach a compromise, but there are still plenty of hot-button issues to deal with in the days ahead, including immigration. More on that in a few minutes. I got to say that the shutdown may have been partial and relatively short, but it did seem to rattle the country for about 72 hours or so. And that got us wondering how other nations deal with their government dysfunction. Take Germany. The country technically isn't shut down, but nearly 4 months after federal elections there, Chancellor Angela Merkel and a conservative bloc still have not formed a new government.
There is actually a government. The previous government is still in power as a caretaker government.
Constanze Seltzenmuller is a senior fellow at the Center on the U.S. and Europe at the Brookings Institution. A reminder on how Germany got to this no-government moment. The Social Democrats, who've traditionally shared power with Merkel, ruled out a partnership with the chancellor and her Christian Democratic Union after last September's election. Talks with other parties failed back in November, but Social Democrats are now beginning to change their tune on partnering up with Merkel and her party.
What we had now on the weekend was the Social Democrats voting on whether to enter into a third grand coalition, and they decided to do so by a knife-edge vote on Sunday, which will now lead to negotiations for a government. But it's not as though Germany is not being run at this point. It is.
It's just that it isn't a coalition for Angela Merkel to work with. I mean, caretaker government, that sounds pretty temporary.
Arguably, the difference is that a caretaker government won't undertake major new initiatives, of course, because they don't have an electoral mandate for that. And one of the things, of course, that everybody's waiting for is German leadership on questions of foreign and security policy, in particular the proposals of French President Emmanuel Macron on making Europe or the European Union more resilient by deepening integration, for example, in the currency zone, the eurozone, a more unified migration policy. All those issues have been sort of on ice, pending the conclusion of the German conversation.
So what happens if Merkel can't form a new government?
I think that that's an entirely legitimate question. It's not improbable that that could happen. It is possible that Merkel would have to call new elections, and it is also possible that within her party there would be a call for new leadership, and Merkel might see herself forced to step down if she found that she no longer had the support of her own party. This is all uncharted territory for Germany. We have not been in a situation where we have taken so long to form a government, although I will say at the same time, other European countries have taken longer. If this does happen by Easter, as they're hoping now, it will be 170 days, and the Dutch, I think, took 259 days, and the Belgians longer than a year. But for Germans, this is very unsettling.
And what issues might get in the way of forming a coalition for Merkel?
The Social Democrats, they want more concessions on health policy. They want more concession on reuniting refugees with their families that have stayed behind in their countries of origin. All of these are issues of social justice for the Social Democrats. But we all understand that for those Social Democrats who simply want a change in the leadership of the two big parties, including their own party, they may also be advancing these maximalist proposals in order to make sure that there is no coalition agreement. So while this is to some degree about substance and about policy, it's also about power and politics and leadership changes.
So, Constanza, a final question, because you're in Washington right now. Are you seeing any parallels with what's happening on the Hill and in Germany? I know, as you rightly point out, Germany's government isn't shut down, but politically you're saying things that sound familiarly divisive, like health policy and refugee policy.
On the surface, you could argue that we are seeing in Germany a gridlock, and we're seeing gridlock in Washington as well. But I think we shouldn't take the parallels too far. Many of the structural components of the polarization of American politics are actually lacking in Germany and much of the rest of Europe. We don't have the kind of income inequality. We don't have anything remotely like the influence that political action campaigns have on politics in America, in Germany. And in many ways, German democratic institutions, parties, and other social institutions like the churches provide for greater stability than they do here. But there are other reasons, of course, for instability in Germany. And Germans are fully aware that their country is changing and that their politics and their institutions may need to change with them.
Constanza Stelzenmüller there. She's with the Brookings Institution in Washington. How many days did Constanza say Belgium was without a government?
I believe she said for over a year, and the exact number, Marco, is 589.
That's the World's Clark Boyd, who was in Brussels for the World between 2010 and 2012. And what was going on?
So, Marco, again, like Constanza said, it's not that there wasn't a federal government. It's just that there was a caretaker government. And just like in Germany's case, in Belgium's case, it was the previous government that kind of kept providing basic services while all of the different factions and parties tried to come together and negotiate some sort of new government.
And how active were they in that negotiation? And after a while, did they just kind of give up and say, well, it'll come back together at some point?
They never gave up. But it was quite a process to see, because what they would do was they'd have all of these different leaders from all of these different parties. And here you have to remember that Belgium is kind of split between the Dutch-speaking north and the French-speaking south. And then there's Brussels, which is bilingual. And there's a German minority over in the, you know, over by the German border. It's a very, very complicated place politically. And a lot of the power is actually devolved from the federal government out to regional parliaments and out to the different language communities. So you have a lot of dispersal of power there. And so what they would do is they'd have all of these different parties at the national level trying to come together, and they kept naming what they would call an informateur. It was the person who was supposed to somehow mediate and negotiate all this. And they would go through a succession of these people, because they would try and they would try and they would fail. And then they'd try somebody else. And then the first guy that they tried would come back in again. So it was just this ongoing thing.
And how did you see the effects of this government shutdown in Belgium in your day-to-day life? And what about other people?
Well, I think personally, one thing that got very much delayed by the federal shutdown was all of the immigration paperwork that me and my family had to do to get into the country. As far as what others were experiencing, I know that foreign policy in general suffered quite a bit. It's like what Constanza talked about in the interview that we just heard. Big initiatives couldn't get done. You can really only plan short term, Marco, if you've got a caretaker government in place.
Yeah, it sounds really familiar.
Yeah, eerily familiar, I would say. You know, living through this now in the United States, you are seeing those kinds of effects.
How was the whole thing resolved in Belgium?
Well, they finally, after 540-some days, they finally struck a deal that at least three or four of the parties could deal with enough to cobble together one of these coalitions, no matter how short-lived.
The World's Clark Boyd. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Marco.
Our shutdown may be over, but you can bet the Democrats and Republicans will continue to spar over immigration. And one name comes up a lot when we're talking about President Trump and immigration, Stephen Miller, 32 years old, a White House advisor who's said to have the president's ear when it comes to things like the wall, DACA, and so-called chain migration. Josh Dawsey is the Washington Post's White House reporter. He says that Miller's warm relationship with Trump has put him in a good position to push his hardline views on immigration.
He was an early campaign aide. He was one of the original coterie that traveled with the president on the plane. He introduced him at rallies on the 2016 campaign. He was the one who shaped the president's thinking on immigration with his policies. He wrote many of the president's speeches, if not most of the president's speeches. And he has maneuvered in the White House in a smart way that others haven't. He at first was aligned with Steve Bannon, found a way to distance himself from Steve Bannon once the former chief strategist was on the routes. He worked for Jeff Sessions in the Senate. The two of them worked together to kind of kill the Gang of Eight immigration bill in the Obama presidency. But when Sessions has now been on the outs with Trump, Stephen Miller has distanced himself from Sessions. He's someone who is seen internally as a shrewd political player who knows how to both channel and cater to his boss's instincts.
Now, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham and Democratic Senator Dick Durbin were working on a bipartisan immigration deal that got derailed. Graham has blamed Stephen Miller. How does Graham see how that all went down?
Graham says that the president's instincts are to be more bipartisan and to, you know, strike these bigger deals, and that interference is run by John Kelly, his chief of staff, and Stephen Miller to push, you know, further right legislation. I think Graham's understanding of this, that Miller is a big puppeteer that's kind of pulling all the strings and telling the president what to do, though, is a little overstated. You know, Miller basically channels a lot of what his boss thinks on immigration. Now, the president is more akin to striking deals and giving in than Miller. I mean, Miller's a fierce restrictionist. But Stephen Miller and John Kelly are able to operate the way they do because they have blessings from the boss. At any point, President Trump could say, no, I don't care what you gentlemen think. We're doing this deal. But so far, he has allowed himself to be advised by these gentlemen. So the criticism of Miller as a proxy for the president is an interesting one to me, because at the end of the day, you know where the buck stops. The buck stops with the president.
So how do Stephen Miller and John Kelly, chief of staff at the White House, how do they both kind of work the president? I mean, how are they doing this tag team act on immigration?
Both of them are ideological allies. The two of them together have worked to put together these more conservative policies to push the president on. And what they've repeatedly told the president is, listen, you won this election a lot of based on immigration. And if you're not really hard on immigration, the base is not going to appreciate it. What was the point of the election? So I think what they try to do is channel what the president said on the campaign trail and convince him that those should be his policies in office. Because as we've reported and others have reported, the president is often a little wobbly on policy. He will say one thing and do something else the next day.
And how do others in the White House view Stephen Miller and John Kelly, especially on this particular issue of immigration?
Well, it actually surprised us a little. We were not sure with some of his divisive rhetoric if Stephen Miller was particularly well-liked in the White House. But in reporting his profile, we spoke to people on both ends of the ideological spectrum in the White House and found that a lot of people think he is a good colleague and is good to have around the president. Stephen Miller is far more deferential to the president than some aides. In our reporting, you'll find a lot of people in the White House who roll their eyes at the president's tweets or at his impulses or the way he behaves. But Stephen Miller is in a lot of ways loyal and deferential to a fault. And one reason why I think that is he's always been an immigration hardliner when he was with Sessions, even as an activist at Duke University. And he finally has a president who will actually help him push some of these policies along.
So, Josh, wrap this up for us. How would you say, when it comes to Stephen Miller and John Kelly, how have they influenced how we're talking about immigration a year on?
In some ways, the president's rhetoric hasn't moved that much from betrayal, where he said, build the wall, and the Mexicans are rapists and drug dealers, and some of them maybe are good people. You still have a president who's espousing for a wall. You still have a president who wants to end the visa lottery system. I think some of the more moderate Republicans and some of the president's outside advisors in the business world and people he's known his whole life really hoped he would moderate a little bit. And I think what Kelly and Miller are really trying to do is to keep the president from moving too far back to the center on immigration. They, you know, tell him there's a lot of political peril in that, and you don't want to be that way. So I don't know that his rhetoric has changed a lot on immigration over the past year, and I think a lot of that is to the credit of Stephen Miller.
Washington Post White House reporter Josh Dawsey, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much.
Just ahead, how the role of the U.S. in the Middle East is changing, and changing fast. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Today, Vice President Mike Pence addressed the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, in Jerusalem, and he said that his boss was going to make good on a promise.
Jerusalem is Israel's capital. And as such, President Trump has directed the State Department to immediately begin preparations to move the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Of course, following through on the promise to move the embassy building would be a further divisive move on Mitty's policy for the White House. So let's run down some recent developments. Trump has slashed aid to the Palestinians and publicly embraced Saudi Arabia. Then there's a recent decision to return to a policy of pursuing regime change in Syria. What does this all add up to? Borzu Daragahi is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News, and he joins us from Istanbul. So these actions and statements, Borzu, are certainly disruptive. Some critics might say they're incoherent. But from where you are in Istanbul, what does it all look like?
I mean, it's hard to figure out what U.S. policy is about at this point. But it seems that in many ways it's contradictory. And also, I think that it's kind of extraordinary with regard to, for example, certain ongoing conflicts, how the U.S. can't seem to really make any new friends, so to speak. So, of course, you know, the U.S. And the Trump administration have a solid relationship with Saudi Arabia and with Israel. But, you know, they seem to be alienating just about everybody else at this point. And that includes the Palestinians, Syrians and Iranians. They couldn't give a hoot about. So I think that's pretty understandable that there are not good relations there. But also allies such as Turkey, relations are strained. And also the Kurds of both Iraq and Syria, relations are very strained at this point. There's a lot of questions about where this is all headed and whose side the U.S. is on.
So we're going to hit a lot of these points in the next few minutes. But tell me what you see as most contradictory about U.S. policy toward the Mideast right now.
I mean, on the one hand, I mean, there's so many different things. I'm not sure if it's hard to qualify which is the most contradictory. I mean, I think the biggest thing is patching up relations with Russia. On the other hand, confronting Iran. Well, I don't think that's going to work, really, because the Russians and Iranians are very closely allied, and they have a sort of agenda that's very much in tandem. So if you oppose the Iranian project, you're in many ways opposing Russia as well. On the one hand, they needed the Kurds of both Syria and Iraq to help fight against ISIS. But, you know, supporting those Kurds and continuing to support them has very much upset Turkey, which is a NATO partner and ally. And meanwhile, you know, Turkey has made a number of requests of the United States, none of which the U.S. has fulfilled. And so, you know, in a way, it seems like many people feel that the U.S. is letting them down, but, you know, at no real advantage to its own ends.
Yeah, it's like a stranger came in the room and just rearranged all the pieces on the chessboard. Over the weekend, here's an interesting example. Mike Pence was in Jordan meeting with King Abdullah. And historically, Jordan's been a strong U.S. ally. But what was the sense you got after that meeting between Pence and King Abdullah?
Jordan is not very happy at all with the U.S. and its decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and to eventually move its embassy up there. The Jordanians are not happy about it at all. They feel it's disruptive. It makes the U.S. even more toxic. The Jordanian establishment plays a very delicate game. On the one hand, it has excellent security and political and economic relations with the United States. On the other hand, it has a population that's half Palestinian, and it sort of walks this precarious tightrope in the region politically and geopolitically. And so this just complicates matters for it. It makes it much harder to be a U.S. ally for countries like Jordan or even the Gulf states to a certain extent. It's seen as gratuitous. It was, you know, messing with a good thing. And I think that many people, many leaders understand that this was, you know, in many respects, this decision, they see it as a cynical domestic ploy by a weak president who needs to shore up his base by giving them something. The cynicism of that, it makes it even worse. It's not out of principle or ideas. It's just this, you know, short-term political gain. And they understand that in this part of the world because they understand U.S. politics. And that makes them even more wary and untrusting of the U.S.
So back to the big picture, Borzu, what is your sense in terms of coherence and vision of Trump White House Mideast policy?
I think that the way that the U.S. is operating right now is completely based on domestic political considerations. And I think that that is a only way to explain some of its moves. And it has, you know, to some extent, ceded the ground to other players. Let's just take one example. You know, this whole move with Turkey, this in the last few days, is a really undercovered move on the part of the Turkish government to basically invade a part of Syria and attempt to topple the ruling establishment of the Syrian Kurds. And the ironic thing is that you have U.S.-trained and armed Syrian rebels that are aligned with Turkey fighting U.S.-trained and armed Kurdish rebels that are aligned with the U.S. So this is the kind of pathetic and contradictory situation of the U.S., a situation that could turn catastrophic.
So, Borzu, are we looking at a kind of a more formal alliance between the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia against Iran and Russia and maybe Turkey? I mean, does this formalize things that kind of feel like they've been unofficial for a while anyway?
Well, I mean, that alliance that you kind of describe has been in the works really for decades.
Right.
You know, this sort of alliance between the so-called moderate Arab states, the U.S. and Israel, against the Russians, the Iranians, the Syrians, and maybe even you could include China in that, the people who are against U.S. hegemony in the region. So, I mean, is it turning into something formal? Actually, it could have turned into something more formal if you didn't have this sort of own goal of this Jerusalem move. Makes it almost impossible for Saudi to come out openly and sort of form an alliance with Israel and the United States, because that would basically cede its position in the Muslim world and the Arab world. They would no longer be able to claim a leadership role if they were to partner with Israel and the United States at this point because of that Jerusalem move. And this is why a lot of the U.S. moves seem rather incoherent, is because they are incoherent, because they don't make sense and they contradict U.S. aims.
Borzu Dargahi of BuzzFeed News. Always great to get your take on these things. Thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The world is trying something new, looking at climate change through the eyes and lives of children in four different countries. Later this week, we'll meet Levi Draheim. He's 10 years old and lives on Florida's Atlantic coast.
There's like these maps, and it shows that this whole entire street will be completely underwater. We're 0 feet above sea level. So even if the polar ice caps melt a little bit, it'll go into the ocean, which is going to go into the Indian River Lagoon, which is going to flood our home.
Levi is responding to the threat by becoming a climate activist. Tomorrow, though, we'll start the series in northwestern Peru. Families are returning to a village there that was ravaged by floods. For months, there was not enough food, and the kids got really sick. Same thing happened nearby 20 years ago.
What we found is that the children who were living in communities the most affected by flooding had the worst loss in height.
We'll visit some of those children, now adults, to see what may be ahead for young victims of this year's floods. That's tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman. So what happens when you ask people at a pro-life rally about immigration? You find out that for some of them, being pro-life also means being pro-immigrant.
People coming into our country, they have the right to life here. People should have the right to come in here. Like, we don't know what their story is.
That story, plus why women marched in Poland, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. And this was This Weekend in Berlin.
From Germany to Mexico, all the walls have got to go. From Germany to
More than a
Mexico,
few pink knit caps spotted in Germany. Same in France, the UK, Italy, Greece, and of course, a year on from the inauguration of Donald Trump and the first women's march, a lot of marching here in the States. Los Angeles reportedly had the largest turnout, more than 500,000, according to LA's mayor. But New York City's wasn't exactly shabby, and that's where we start our coverage with the world's Across Women's Lives correspondent, Jasmine Garst, who was reporting at the march in New York. Jazz, what was the turnout like there?
It was a really healthy turnout. 200,000 people took to the streets of New York around the Central Park area, and the weather was great, and people were loud. They had big signs. So I would say it was a very healthy turnout.
Now, one of the critiques, Jazz, of the first march, I should say marches last year, is that it was very much a white event, a white feminist event. Did you get a sense of whether this was a more inclusive protest this time around? And how much was that a talking point as you worked your way through the crowd?
That was definitely a talking point. I mean, it still felt like a white feminist event, to be quite honest. But there was a diverse crowd. I mean, there were plenty of diverse protesters. I spoke to one woman who was a Haitian-American protester, and she was saying, you know, it is really lonely out here for someone like me, a feminist, a Black feminist, to be here, and there's not a lot of inclusivity, but I'm still going to stand here. You know, I also spoke to this woman who is from Costa Rica, Xenia Freilich. She's a scientist. She's a biologist at the City University of New York, and she said she was there as a Latina, as a woman, and as a scientist under an administration that has not been so friendly to foreign researchers.
Not only the future of research, but also the future of the environment. I don't want to sound like a doom and gloom, but, you know, we have closed our eyes to a big problem, and it's, you know, this planet is a sick planet. When we look at the environment, there's no place that we can say is a pristine place anymore.
You know, Marco, I spoke to a lot of people, and when I asked, what is the objective of this march? What is the theme? They weren't entirely able to answer. But something that most people use the word intersectionality. And I think what they're getting at is this is an administration under which a lot of different issues, a lot of different sectors of society have felt under attack, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's women's rights, whether it's immigrant rights, whether it's science. And you know, that intersectionality, I think, was about, look, we're all coming from different places, but we're all coming from a place of concern.
Also in the last march, one of the critiques, and you kind of hit on it there, Jasmine, is that it lacked focus. So did you hear a focus?
You know, that's a tough question, which is the answer every protester I spoke to gave me when I said, you know, what is the objective of your protest? Pretty much everyone said, oh, that's a tough answer. I mean, here's the sense that I got. This was a march to say, we're here. We're here and we're worried for many different reasons, but we're here. It was almost more like an act of presence than a protest, from what I could see. I spoke to one father who had brought his daughter. He is a Filipino-American man, Dexter Tanabe. And he said, you know, I'm just here to show my daughter that this is important to us.
So my emphasis was just, you know, we march because we want everybody to be nice to everybody, whether a girl or a boy or whether you're this or that. Everybody just needs to be nice and respectful to everybody. And I think that's something that she can comprehend for now. I didn't want to overwhelm her with, you know, all these things, but obviously that's important.
You know, something that's really interesting is I spoke to a lot of parents at this march who had either left their kids at home, but a lot of parents who brought their kids. And, you know, we ended up having some really interesting conversations about how you were raised versus how you're raising your kids in the era of Me Too. Like, I spoke to this one couple who was telling me, she was saying to me, you know, when I was a kid, I remember I had an internship and my boss grabbed me. He just grabbed my butt. And my mom, who was a feminist, said to me, well, you know, some guys are like that. And she was telling me, I'm here so that my kids don't have to hear that from me. I think this is a really interesting moment for parents. Like, what are we going to teach our kids differently?
Yeah, maybe by going to a march, there's some advice or guidance they can pick up on. Jasmine Garst, our Across Women's Lives correspondent, she joined us today from New York, where she is based. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Now, the U.S. isn't the only place where women have been marching. In Poland, thousands of women took to the streets last week. They were protesting a move by the government there to place more restrictions on abortion. The World's Karolina Chorvath has been following the ongoing abortion debate in Poland. So what do current laws in Poland say about abortion, and what would this proposal that was the source of all this protest, what would that proposal do?
So abortion laws in Poland are already among the most strict in the EU. Abortions are already illegal, except in three cases, which is the case of rape, or if the mother or the fetus were to suffer irreversible damage. This new law would basically get rid of the damage to the fetus exception. So if it were to pass, you wouldn't be able to get an abortion if a baby had a range of conditions, range of health concerns that you could test for in the womb, like Down syndrome or cerebral palsy.
So strict abortion laws and getting stricter if this goes through. Why does Poland have such strict laws on abortion?
Poland is largely a Catholic country. About 87% of Poles declare themselves Catholic. And the Catholic Church and the ruling Law and Justice Party have a really strong connection. During communism, the church was actually one of the few places where Polish people could speak Polish, where they could organize. So there's a huge sense of loyalty between the current government that's very anti-communist and the church.
So describe the marches last week. Like, who came out and what was the mood?
Of course, it was mainly women across the country. About 50 cities participated in the movement. They were all donned in black, took to the streets. A lot of their signs said Deja Vu Women's Strike or Deja Vu Strike Kobiet, which was a nod back to the 2016 marches where there was a similar bill proposed.
So take us back to 2016. What triggered those marches exactly? And did those protesters have any impact on Poland's national conversation about abortion?
Yeah, in fact, they did. In 2016, there was a proposed bill that would completely ban the right to abortion. And there were millions of women across the country that came together to protest the ban of abortion. They came out in black. They were standing in cold and in rain for hours, and they had support actually across the world. People at different embassies around the world stood in solidarity with these women in Poland. So post the 2016 marches, there was a surprising change in public opinion toward whether or not women have the right to choose. Mm-hmm. And there's been about a 20% increase of Polish people believing that women do have that right to choose since the 2016 protests.
So it sounds like there was some progress for the people who were protesting between 2016 and now. But what about reaction to the marches this time, this past week in Poland? Does that give us any sense of whether the wind is blowing in the favor of the protesters this time?
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to tell from Polish media. They definitely focused on the protests that were in Warsaw. But throughout the rest of the country, there was a relatively strong turnout from women. At this point, women are definitely waiting in the wings to see what the next step will be and how they're going to need to respond.
Karolina Czorwath, the world's digital editor, telling us about women's marches in Poland for reproductive rights. Karolina, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
And one more march to mention here, this one against abortion. On Friday, tens of thousands of people took part in the 45th annual March for Life in Washington. It was time to mark today's anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision. Vice President Mike Pence addressed the crowd on the National Mall via Jumbotron.
And distinct privilege to introduce to you the 45th President of the United States of America, President Donald Trump.
Trump told the crowd that his administration is with them, standing for the gift of life.
That is why we march. That is why we pray. And that is why we declare that America's future will be filled with goodness, peace, joy, dignity, and life for every child of God.
The world's religion reporter Matthew Bell talked with some of the marchers about what they mean when they say they are pro-life.
Tony Melendez is a 56-year-old musician. Like a lot of folks here, he's Catholic, and Melendez has been coming to this march for years. But this one feels special, he says. He was born in Nicaragua without any arms, and he says his own life story is a strong case against abortion.
So to be here today, with Donald Trump speaking to President, all these marchers, you know, all different colors, different races standing together, that's beautiful.
Melendez says he voted for Trump, and overall, he believes the president is doing a good job. But some of the marchers I speak with are frustrated. They tell me it's great that Trump and his administration seem to be firmly against abortion, but they're troubled by some of the president's rhetoric and policy decisions. 18-year-old Aubrey Pennington took a 24-hour bus ride from Wichita, Kansas, to be here. She's with her classmates from Cape and Mount Carmel Catholic High School, and she says that being pro-life for her also means being pro-immigrant.
I'd call myself more of a conservative individual, but I feel like people coming into our country, they have the right to life here. Just like people, like babies, they have the right to life. Like, they shouldn't be aborted. Like, people should have the right to come in here. Like, we don't know what their story is.
Among the homemade signs in the crowd is one with a purple elephant and a quote from Dr. Seuss. It says, "A person's a person, no matter how small." Zulenka Quintanilla is holding that sign in one hand. In the other, she's got one that says, "Overturn Roe v. Wade." Quintanilla describes herself as a conservative and a Christian, and she's got family from Bolivia. She says respecting life also means protecting immigrants.
I'm actually third generation, so my grandma came here, brought my mom and aunt when they were young. So definitely it is. It's hard to talk about it, and it's hard being conservative and being seen as I don't support immigration or because I'm a citizen, it doesn't affect me. But of course it does. It's people that come here for the American dream and a better way of life.
For us to be pro-life, it fundamentally means that we need to care about all of life from conception to the grave, from womb to tomb.
That's Jenny Yang, vice president with World Relief, a Christian nonprofit that works with refugees. It might be unpopular with some conservatives, but Yang tells her fellow Christians that respecting all of human life also means being pro-refugee. She says it's all right there in the Bible.
Specifically for evangelicals, if we are people who believe the truth about Scripture and believes that truth should apply in all areas of our life, then you can't separate out certain things that you think apart from the truth of the gospel.
When Yang heard about the vulgar comments attributed to President Trump last week, describing Haiti and African countries, she says she wasn't all that shocked. After all, she's been watching the Trump administration's moves on immigration policy closely, and she's not impressed.
They're actually implementing policies in which they believe that people are coming from places that are, you know, irredeemable or corrupt or, you know, reasons why they shouldn't be coming into this country. And that's not been the history of immigration to our country. In fact, we've accepted thousands of people who have been completely illiterate and desperately poor. I mean, that's how our nation was founded, by people who were fleeing persecution. And they were people who were resilient. And it didn't have anything to do with where they were coming from, their nationality or the color of their skin.
But speaking up can be tough, says Russell Moore. He's the head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, an evangelical advocacy group. Speaking ahead of the March for Life, Moore said, it's always been risky for people of faith to raise unpopular ideas, but that doesn't mean they should stay quiet.
If you're in a place where everybody already agrees with you on the life issue and on the family issue, but you stand up and say, yeah, and the image of God also applies to this immigrant family that's moved into your community that people are screaming at and calling anchor babies and go home. It takes a good deal of courage to stand up and say, I'm going to take the long term to come up and not to follow whatever the mob is doing right now, but to come in and to seek to lead.
As one woman at the March for Life tells me, today we're protesting against abortion, but tomorrow we should march for the dreamers, the DACA recipients who could face deportation. For The World, Matthew Bell, Washington.
Here's one more story for you about the women's marches held across the globe over the weekend. This one's from Arizona, where indigenous rights groups marched in solidarity. Shandine Silversmith is a digital producer at Gannett in Phoenix, Arizona. I asked her to describe the march there.
So it was really interesting because a lot of women were wearing the pink pussy hats, but for the Indigenous Women's March, you could see a lot of Indigenous men and women wearing red. And that was their way of honoring the missing and murdered Indigenous women who are affected in Canada and in the United States. So it was a way to tribute them by wearing red.
So how did that very important concern for Indigenous people kind of mesh with the other issues central to the Me Too campaign overall?
It surrounds around the fact that Indigenous women have a high rate of sexual violence and domestic violence. So indigenous communities are also affected by these issues, even though they're not broadly talked about. For instance, one of the women that I spoke to, her name was Karen Begay, and she's a Diné woman from the Navajo Nation. And she said one of the main reasons that she was there is because her mother was murdered when she was 12 years old. And she was carrying a Navajo Nation flag that had a bunch of strings tied to it in the four sacred colors for indigenous people, which is black, yellow, red, and white. And she said the string at the top of the pole is dedicated to her mother because she is one of those women, a part of the list for missing and murdered indigenous people.
Shandine, the idea that the Me Too movement has not always done its best to remember the women of color without a voice out there who have suffered the same things that many have been talking about in this movement. Were the indigenous marchers making this point?
I think so, because a lot of people, not only from one tribal nation, but from several in Arizona, from across the nation, turned out to show that they are there to support this movement. They are there to show that women in indigenous communities are going missing and are being affected in this way. So I think it showed that this issue isn't something that can just be pushed aside. It's something that they really want people to pay attention to.
What was the overall mood? I mean, here we are a year after the big marches that kind of staked a claim of resistance against the Trump administration. What was the mood there in Phoenix?
I think the mood was still very prevalent that these women and these men supporting these women are very disappointed and have this, I guess you can say, frustration that they want to voice with this current administration. And when I got there, because I went to the march just to observe and take pictures, and seeing all these people from different tribes and different nations, it personally made me feel very empowered. As an indigenous woman, I don't get to see that very often, especially in major marches across the world. So being able to see a big group of indigenous men and women standing up for issues that are affecting them and are affecting thousands of other indigenous people, it was really empowering. And you can feel it just by seeing all of these people in red walking with their traditional regalia and walking in their moccasins. And it was great. It was really great. I was happy to witness it.
Shandine, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
So who says you need extensive political experience to be a world leader? I'm actually talking about George Weah, Liberia's new president. Country giant, that's what many Liberians call him. Weah was considered to be one of the best soccer players on the planet back in the 1990s. But did that get him ready to lead his country? My BBC colleague Tamison Ford reports from Monrovia.
Liberia's motorbike riders wait for customers in the shade of a drooping mango tree. These are the hardcore George Weah fans, pen riders as they're known. Most of them are young, former soldiers from the war.
I want for him to focus on the youth, more especially focus on young people.
Like almost everyone, 27-year-old Emmanuel Zeze has big expectations for the country giant, as Weah is known here.
George Weah going past now.
Yeah, sure. That's the country giant in the city right
now. That's the country giant
Yeah.
15 years after one of the most brutal civil wars in Africa, poverty is still endemic. More than half the population lives on less than $2 a day, according to the World Bank. Liberia has the highest number of out-of-school children in the world at nearly two-thirds, claims UNICEF. And unemployment is rampant.
Unemployment is one of the biggest challenges for the new government.
Valai Dawley is a Liberian economist.
Many of the people that are unemployed, about 70% of them voted for Ambassador Weah, and they believe that Ambassador Weah can take them from the slum community. So it's a very big challenge for him.
President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf secured nearly $5 billion of debt relief during her first term. She attracted investors from all over the world. But the country is still reeling from a devastating Ebola epidemic, and investors have been scared away.
We have this double shock that hit the economy.
President Weah visits the central mosque in the heart of town. President Sirleaf sits beside him as they say a prayer for Liberia together. The footballing legend says he has no doubt he can turn the economy around.
I know I'm going to meet the expectation, because that one thing, when people love you, you have to strive for them. Liberians love me, and to make sure that they are okay, I'm going to do it again. So there's a lot of expectation, but we will meet the expectation. I'm excited.
...49-year-old Catherine Weir, no relation to the new president, stands beside her small wooden stall on the outskirts of Monrovia. She sells small things like soap, biscuits and sweets. She has no running water, and like most of the country, she has no electricity. And she's the sole breadwinner for her five children.
Well, electricity would be very happy because of what? It will help her too.
When electricity comes, she says, we'll be very happy because it will help us. We're suffering here.
So we don't want suffering, of course. No, electricity will be very happy.
With this new man, she says, referring to George Weir, I know the country will be fine.
So, it'll be fine. You know, eh?
Tamasin Ford, Monrovia, Liberia.
Well, George Weir believes he's got faith and love on his side. That's a pretty good start. A hopeful parting thought for you on this Monday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.